Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can the U.S. and India do for one another and for the rest of the world? The State Department has identified four focus areas for the ongoing development of U.S.-India relations: science and technology, human development, economic activity, and global security. So what will determine the ability of the world's two largest democracies to succeed together on those fronts? His Excellency Swashpavan Singh is here to talk about it. He has served as Ambassador of India to the offices of the United Nations in Geneva, as well as Ambassador to Kuwait, and was India's first Consul General to Houston. He's in town at the invitation of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. He'll address the group tomorrow night at a sold-out event at the Crow Collection of Asian Art, which is co-sponsoring it in downtown Dallas. You can learn more about the group at dfwworld.org. Your Excellency, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Robert Blake, the Assistant U.S. Secretary of the Bureau of South and Central Asian Affairs, has called the U.S. and India natural allies. What does that statement mean to you?
You know, there's a lot that's been said about how India and the USA should really have been closer friends for a much longer period of time. And if you look at it in terms of shared value systems, in terms of being democracies, pluralistic, secular, have a colonial past, there's a lot that the two countries have shared in a historical sense. But for reasons which we can talk about briefly, since the Second World War and since India's independence, there was a gap. The world was different, and there were different perceptions of how to move ahead and sort of. I don't know about natural allies, because international relations are hard-headed national interest pursuits by nation states.
Doesn't come naturally, necessarily.
Everything is structured. These are conscious decisions taken. What might make it that kind of description relevant is when you say, okay, there are natural elements that should have brought them together. Allies, again, a loaded word in international relations. Alliances are over issues, over shared national interests, over convergences of viewpoints. Sometimes allies suggests more in terms of a process of, say, a warlike situation, the two world wars, who was allied with whom and who fought. They call the allied troops. So these terms, I think, need redefinition. When we talk about allies today, what you can say is, depending upon a certain set of issues, you may have a group of countries that come together, and so they're allied on that issue, but they may not agree on everything. And I think that's part of the strength of the Indo-US relationship. We are old civilizations. You are the oldest democracy. We in India are the largest democracy. But as democracies, we have our people who determine what we should do as governments. And there are things on which we don't agree. There are differences in perception. So I think the great struggle is going to be, how do these two friends, who should have been friendlier than in the past, can come together on shared perceptions and issues and find a common ground to work together. Whether these are going to be natural allies or not, I don't know, but certainly closer friends than they have been in the past.
Has India, under the Obama administration, consistently received the amount of attention that it deserves?
You know, when in the U.S. system, when one system, one president succeeds another president, there are differences of perception in terms of their public expression of policy. But when they actually come into the White House, they realize they're inheriting a legacy of bureaucratic positions, of attitudes which have been, in a way, ingrained within the system they inherit. There was, under with the Bush presidency, a close relationship between India and the U.S., particularly over the nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. That became, in some ways, 2005 onwards, a sort of measure of how much the two countries were beginning to agree on issues. We see no difference in that as far as the Obama regime is concerned. He and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton voted for it. And we have clear indications after the Secretary of State's visit to Delhi recently that the Obama regime presidency is equally committed to the nuclear deal. So I think on substantive issues, on core issues, there seems to be very little that's different. It's also fair to recall that it was under President Clinton that this process of a closer relationship with India began. and it took on a strategic dimension. So my own senses, and I speak here in my personal capacity, I see this relationship strengthening further because of a shared value system and shared common concerns about how to address several international issues which no one country can solve by itself.
For people who don't recall specifically the Henry Hyde Act, essentially this was a deal that allowed the U.S. and India to trade for nuclear equipment for power generation.
Yes, it was actually more complex than that. It was an acceptance of India's position as a country that had nuclear weapons, and because of our tests in 1998, there was a technology denial regime that was put into place. I think the 2005 discussion when our prime minister visited here with President Bush began the process of negotiation, which resulted in the nuclear deal, which basically said that we know India is not part of the NPT, but it's been a responsible power, and it has technological capability in this field, and we recognize that. And we will now make it possible to work with India on their civilian nuclear program, which deals with power generation, despite the fact that they are not signatories to the NPT. It was, I think, a recognition of the fact that India had been a responsible country. It had been a country that had the capability, but was very careful to keep it within itself. There was also a realization that India is a billion people. It's a functioning democracy. If it has to grow adequately, it must have energy. And one of the options is nuclear energy. Clearly, nuclear energy is not going to be the dominant one, but it's going to be an important element that does contribute. And there's also the concern that nuclear energy, which is environmentally more friendly, to the extent that that becomes a focus, it would mean India moving gradually in the direction of more environmentally friendly power generation technologies. So it was a recognition of India's good behavior, responsible country, awareness that they have the technology. And this has led to a major difference, which is now technologies which were earlier denied to India will be available.
Of course, a lot of people, the shorthand, I think, for many Americans when they think about conflicts that India has experienced in recent years is to go directly to Pakistan. There are some analysts now who say that China may be an equal or greater threat. The Obama administration has made strong overtures trying to be more friendly also with China. Is that a problem for India?
No, China and India have been friends. We're neighbors. They are a large old civilization, so are we. We've had a history of differences and disagreements on the border. This is part of the colonial inheritance. Some lines were drawn on quarter-inch maps with thick pencils in a terrain which was largely mountainous. And there are differences of perception. We're continuing to talk to our Chinese friends on that. But it's not a zero-sum game. You know, China has done superbly well in economic terms over the last 20, 30 years. India's got very good bilateral commercial and economic relations with China. And we think that China and India can together remain friends, become economically viable, and support each other. At the same time, realistically, we have to accept, yes, there are differences. They have a different political system. We have a different political system. At some stage, China will have to address the political system it has. How do you introduce economic democracy, which is the price mechanism, and make that a fact of life on the ground for your people, and then not give them the political freedom to make a choice? How does that transition happen? How will they manage it? That's a good question for the future. But clearly, in economic terms, China has done superbly well. And I think as India recognizes China as an important neighbor, I mean, there are differences on various issues, and those differences will continue to be addressed and discussed. And yes, in a long-term point of view, we have to see how both these countries, given their large populations, will be accommodated in a peaceful sense in Asia and in the rest of the world.
My guest is His Excellency Swashpavan Singh, former ambassador of India to the offices of the United Nations in Geneva. One place that I would imagine that India and China are in a similar position is in terms of the environment and the on a global scale, the United States is saying, well, we need to be committed to fixing our historic contribution to global warming. However, we want to make sure that countries that are developing as quickly as China and, of course, as India don't sort of get to where we were. Do you feel that the United States is taking an appropriate responsibility for the damage that's already been done?
You know, this whole process of climate change has been discussed for many years now in the UN and under various formats. We believe that there is a common but differentiated responsibility in terms of addressing this problem. Clearly, the developed countries, the industrialized countries, have over the years contributed a significant amount to these greenhouse gases. If you take a per capita measure, India is amongst the smallest. We contribute the least. Even China is higher than us, significantly higher than us. I think we are 4 and they're 6.5 or 7, and the U.S. is 30-something. So, I mean, there's a huge gap. I think clearly there is a realization, certainly in India, that we need to have more efficient technologies. We need to have better ways of reducing the contribution to greenhouse gases. But I think equally there is this imperative of economic development. We are 1 billion people, 1 billion, 100 million people. We have serious poverty issues, development issues. We need energy. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, how do we continue to ensure growth, economic growth, and equitable growth so that poverty can be addressed, our economic development can continue, while at the same time being fully aware and conscious that we must do everything to minimize the amount of greenhouse gases that we will emit into the atmosphere as a consequence of our development. Our Prime Minister made a statement saying that at no point would our per capita responsibility go above, or the amount we emit go above what the developed countries are doing. So really, we have a little space to go up on the condition that those who are already way ahead come down. And this balance has to be found.
What do you think is the most appropriate role for the West in making that possible, if any?
You know, the discussions have gone on. There was the meeting in Bali. There were recent meetings. There's going to be this meeting in Copenhagen that we're all going towards. I think fundamental principles have to be accepted. The Kyoto Protocol, for example, it's a continuous protocol. It does not end. It's not as if there's going to be a new protocol. Even commitments that were made under that particular protocol have not yet so far been honored. So we have to find, how do you go about to finding this balance? Those who are already polluting or have historically polluted, they have to set some benchmarks for themselves and start meeting those. On the other hand, there are these two aspects of mitigation and adaptation. How do you mitigate it? And then how do you adapt? Clearly, say, take coal technology, coal-based power thermal plants. If there's modern technology available which reduces emissions, is that technology going to be made available? And if it is, at what cost? And will there be intellectual property issues, patent issues? Where will the capital funding come from? These are all issues that are being discussed. We have to find a way to ensure that development is not retarded. And yet the technologies that are available today internationally are made available so that the growth is a more environmentally friendly growth.
We'll return in a moment to our conversation with His Excellency Swashpavan Singh. He's former ambassador of India to the offices of the United Nations in Geneva, in town for a World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth event tomorrow night. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking today about the relationship between the United States and India with His Excellency Swashpavan Singh, who is former ambassador of India to the offices of the United Nations in Geneva. He is in town to speak at the Crow Collection of Asian Art tomorrow night at a World Affairs Council event. The event is sold out, but you can learn more about the World Affairs Council at dfwworld.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. India continues to grow at a really remarkable rate. I think it was 6% last year, despite the rest of the world being mired in this recession. Do you see that Indian investment in the United States is likely to increase given the way things have changed?
Yeah, I think it's going to be both ways. The U.S. is a major investor in India. The Indian economy is growing rapidly, and it has grown well. And I think there will be more opportunities for foreign investment in India. But increasingly, several of our private sector and public sector companies, corporations, are now seeking to go international, partly because of economies of scale, partly because of market opportunities internationally, and partly to upgrade their technological capabilities. And so there have been buyouts and mergers and investments. So we will see more and more Indian companies coming out internationally and investing. Clearly, the U.S. is the world's largest economy. And for somebody who is seeking an international presence, companies in the USA are a major attraction. Also, the USA is a major market for a lot of our products. And we do find a number of our companies going to places in the neighborhood of the USA and making those production bases to access markets. So Indian private sector entrepreneurship is going to seek opportunities internationally. And I'm sure there will be more and more of Indian companies coming and working with their American partners and friends, partly for their markets, but partly for third country markets.
I know the U.S. is the primary trade partner, as things exist today, for India. U.S. officials have said publicly that protectionism is not something they're interested in the current climate. On the other hand, there are a lot of people who feel that, in fact, words say one thing and actions say quite something else.
Yes, you're right. I think this became a controversial issue. There was some talk about it during the election campaign. There's this sense that somehow third countries are taking jobs away from the USA. This is factually incorrect, actually. And I think there is enough available evidence now that a lot of jobs have been actually added to the US economy because of interaction with companies internationally, including with Indian companies. And in fact, there are statistics of how many jobs Indian companies helped create in the USA. I don't think India is worried, per se. We've talked to our American friends bilaterally. And we understand, for us, as for the USA, having an open international trading system is in our long-term interest. We are too large, both as economies and as countries, to be able to manage within ourselves or only within our limited neighborhoods. The process of globalization has its economic imperatives. And if we want to grow, as you rightly said, at 6, 7, 8% or 9%, which is what we are targeting, we have to have access to international markets. And we have to work with international partners. We have certain obvious advantages in working with our American friends. Language, like I said, similar value systems, pluralism, democracy, et cetera, and sometimes what becomes a problem, a lot of public debate on issues, which the media projects in a particular way, but the reality is sometimes quite different. So my sense is, in India, there was concern. A lot of that concern has abated after discussions. And they both sides see an advantage in keeping the markets open and not indulging in protectionism.
Can India continue to grow at its current rate if the number of U.S. companies that do outsource certain jobs there cut back on that?
Yes. I think, you know, the service sector in India, really the service sector which feeds into outsourcing and international, is relatively speaking small. It contributes a significant amount to the GDP, but the absolute numbers are small. And the value addition that is now taking place is because of vertical integration, adding value to the process, the quality of the outsourcing that is done. I mean, from BPOs and call centers, it's now become primary research that is being done in India by a number of these companies. So the real value that is being added is significantly higher. So we see a tremendous growth potential there, a growth opportunity there. We don't see this actually as a contracting market. We see it as a growing, enormously growing market.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Larray who asks, is it possible in the current global climate to pursue nuclear processes for energy production without the pursuit of nuclear defense applications?
Oh, clearly. I think these are two separate technologies. Mm-hmm. You use nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, for power generation, and for a whole range of other issues. I mean, it's radiation in medicine, in food preservation. There's a whole series of applications. And yes, it is possible to have these as separate. And part of this arrangement that we have made in identifying those that are going to be only for power generation and in the civilian is a recognition that such a division is possible. Yes, indeed.
Can you talk for a minute about the significance of the rather intense military and defense partnership between India and the United States in the Indian Ocean over the past few years?
I'm not sure if I'd describe it as intense. Mm-hmm. It's, I think, beginning of a process. See, if you just look at the map and see where India is in the Indian Ocean, on the west of India is the Gulf, which produces enormous quantities of oil, which are needed all over the world. So if you look at the Suez Canal, the Straits of Hormuz on our west, and you look at the Straits of Malacca on the east, enormous amount of sea lane traffic passes through these. And all countries who are major international traders, and that includes India, US, the Western Group, China, Japan, Australia, they all have interest in ensuring that these sea lanes remain open and protected. And therefore, India has been working with a number of countries and collaborating to ensure that there is a common interest of protecting the freedom of these sea lanes. It's as vital to India's well-being as it is indeed to global trade and commerce. Some of this requires joint operations with various navies to, in a sense, patrol these sea lanes and ensure. You know, recently we had a different kind of problem on piracy around the coast of Yemen, Aden, and Somalia. And then the international community got together and the Indian Navy participated. So clearly India is going to be a major partner and the Indian Navy is being strengthened and will grow in size. Because if you look at India's geopolitical situation, we are in the heart of the Indian Ocean. We have the Bay of Bengal on one side, we have the Arabian Sea. And although we don't claim ownership, it's not for nothing that it's called the Indian Ocean. So we have a large lake, really, which we need to play a role in protecting and defending. So, yes, there will be greater interaction with the USA, but with other navies as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is His Excellency Swashbhavan Singh, former ambassador of India to the offices of the United Nations in Geneva. I wonder if you can talk for a moment. You did a turn at the embassy in Kabul. Can you talk about what you think the appropriate role is for India in the reconstruction of Afghanistan?
Yes, indeed. I was fortunate to go for my first assignment as a diplomat to Kabul. But these were happier days. This was in the 70s, 76 to 79, before the Soviets had gotten in. It is a peaceful place. You could travel. The Afghans are wonderful people. They are a great people. We had three wonderful years there. And it breaks my heart to see what Afghanistan has had to go through since then. First through because of the Soviet invasion and occupation, and then with the Taliban and the Talibanization and the erosion of their traditional culture and the imposition of another culture led by a very narrow interpretation of faith. Great deal of damage done to education, to children, to women, to the economy. So if you look at Afghanistan and if you look at what Afghanistan's situation today is, it's a pity to see that country having gone through so much pain and trouble. For India, Afghanistan has always been a friend, historically. I mean, there were parts in India's history where parts of Afghanistan were actually ruled out of India. Conversely, we've had several invasions into India from Afghanistan, from Central Asia. So Afghanistan has been a close friend of India. Cultural great similarities, many things that we share with them. India's contribution has been, and we've spent over $1 billion on it, is in reconstruction, in schools, in hospitals. The only children's hospital in Kabul, which was set up by India 30 years ago. We're doing a lot of good work, I think, in terms of replacement of missing limbs, artificial limb center, building a road, helping with microhydral projects, basically to strengthen the people and their capability to lead productive economic lives. And we find a great degree of goodwill and friendship for India amongst the people of Afghanistan. We will continue to remain committed to this growth of interaction in economic sustainable development. But the security situation has a major constraint. There are difficulties. How do you go out into the countryside and actually execute projects when the security situation is not under control? And the situation in Afghanistan today is cause for concern, and I think something needs to be done about it.
How concerned are you that non-military U.S. aid to Pakistan is actually being funneled into activities that could be used against the Indian people?
You know, this has been an old story. The U.S. has friends, and it has a right to have friends. And then those friends behave in a particular way, and they have very little control over how they behave. And then they find ways of justifying it. We've been hurt with it in the past. There has been insurgency in India that's emanated out of there, a lot of the growth of the terrorism, etc. But I think it is really for the U.S. to sit back and ask themselves some hard questions about what kind of assistance they're giving, what control do they have over mechanisms of control, who are they giving it to, how is it being... These are issues that need transparency. These are issues that the Congress needs oversight with. And I think these are issues which have to be understood in terms of their strategic implications for the stability of the region as a whole. You cannot even unwittingly strengthen those who are disruptive, those who are not under the control, those who are being aided and abetted to carry out acts of terrorism, of hurting civilians. There is no earthly justification for anybody to attack children, women, old people, civilians. There's no cause that justifies it. And so the question they have to ask themselves is, all that we're giving them, what kind of end use is it being put to? And who's monitoring it? Not to talk about the arms that are being given and how those are being used. And we've seen some media reports recently. I have no inside information about this, but I'm going by media reports. There are indications that some of these equipment is being modified for end use elsewhere. I think there's an equal responsibility for those who give the aid, as it is for those who receive, to ensure that the purpose is preserved with honesty and transparency. But then for that, you require a democratic system.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is His Excellency Swashpavan Singh, former ambassador of India to the offices of the United Nations in Geneva. Let's go to Srinivasan in Denton. Hi, Srinivasan.
Hi. It's a good show. Thank you. And I have a comment and a question for the ambassador. My comment is, on one hand, at the beginning, the ambassador said that nations go after their personal national interests. And then he keeps on bringing the civilizational ties, and it doesn't make a logical sense. That is my comment. And my question is, when you look at the history of the Indo-U.S. relations, nothing has changed much. But during Afghanistan 1, U.S. needed Pakistan's help, and they winked at the nuclear program. And now you have Afghanistan 2, and you are still seeing nuclear program in Pakistan being accelerated with U.S. support. So the one thing is very clear, that although the world has changed, nothing has changed much in terms of Indo-U.S. relations, and Indians have to take care of themselves. My question is, What is Indian government doing? It appears as if the Indian government has its head very deep in the sand vis-a-vis Pakistan and waiting for them to take it to the next logical step of using nuclear weapons. I'll take the answers off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, if I may comment on the comment first, you know, national interest is very often and very largely also a function of your civilizational inheritance. So when you talk about India's civilization, a lot of India's national interest is defined after India's independence and as included in its constitution, is a reflection of this civilizational heritage. So when we talk about national interest, that national interest is clearly also an expression of our civilizational value system. As far as India and Pakistan are concerned and Afghanistan is concerned, I think you're right. In several ways, very little has changed on the ground. I think it is for the U.S. to evaluate very seriously, given the situation within Pakistan, how they want to proceed in this area. As far as the government of India is concerned, I don't speak for the government of India, happily. I have retired. I'm now a free man, so I'm free to express my point of view. But clearly, I think the issue is different. India and the USA have, over the last 5, 7, 8 years, considerably strengthened their bilateral relationship. It's in a wide range of wide areas, in the economy, in agriculture, in technology, in education, in military interaction, in sharing of intelligence on counterterrorism. I mean, there's a whole range. And those who would come and visit with me tomorrow evening at the Crow Collection, I will have some details of really what is has already been achieved and how much more there is the potential for. So what does happen is hard information about incremental progress doesn't make news. What does make news is sometimes, again, misleading. So don't go by media reports alone. Just look at some issues. Look at what the CEO Forum has recommended. Look at what is the number of delegations that are visiting each other. Look at the number of projects that have been sanctioned. Look at the number of students that continue to come and work in India. Look at the role of the Indian American community in terms of pushing this relationship bilaterally. Look at the statements that have actually been made at the functional level of what has been actually achieved on the ground. And my friend will find that in very hard-headed terms, a lot more is being done today than it was done in the past. And the potential for this to significantly increase in the future because of the removal of the technology denial regime is even greater.
Back in just a moment to our conversation with His Excellency Swashpavan Singh. You can join us at 800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is His Excellency Swashpavan Singh, former ambassador of India to the offices of the United Nations in Geneva. He's in town for a sold-out event tomorrow night at the Crow Collection of Asian Art in downtown Dallas for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. They are co-sponsoring that event. If you want to be part of this afternoon's conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Back to the phones now. And we will speak to Krishna in Plano. Hi, Krishna.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question for the Ambassador, Mr. Singh. My name is Krishna Rao, calling from Plano. Mm-hmm. The question I have is regarding the health concerns of Indian population. I'm very concerned about cigarette smoking, cigarette imports, and also pollution due to diesel and many number of transportation. Is there any measure that Mr. Ambassador would like to propose or something that we should be learning from the U.S. to decrease the health concerns related to these items?
Thanks for your call.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think you have put your finger on a very important issue, which is public health in India. It's a major concern. It's something that the government, and I must clarify, I don't speak for the government, but what the government is very actively involved in. You mentioned smoking. Yes, India has in fact adopted a law under which smoking in public places is now illegal. It's part of our commitment to rule out tobacco, and we supported the convention internationally as well. So more and more of this awareness is there. But we're also a democracy, and in a democracy, the right to exercise your personal preference, even in favor of something as dangerous as tobacco consumption, is a sacred right which is being preserved. So the answer there really lies in education, in making people aware, in using the taxation mechanism to make these products more expensive, less easily available. And I think several steps in that direction are being taken. You mentioned pollution. You're absolutely right. I think there is a major issue there. The question that is being asked is, should India have the number of cars that it has? Should we continue to use, to quote-unquote, the Western model of transportation development? Or should we rely more on public transport? I think the answer there, again, lies in a happy mix of the two. Part of our growth and a part of our sense of modernization, particularly for middle-class India, is the freedom that comes from having an automobile and to be able to operate it. But then is the existing infrastructure large enough for it? Just now, no, it's creating difficulties. But more investment is needed. But I think clearly there is a good case made out, to be made out for public transportation, mass public transportation. Some of it has begun to happen in small ways around Delhi, Calcutta, Bangalore, Mumbai, but it needs much more investment. At the end of the day, for a billion people, 1.1 billion people, I think we have to ask this question. If good public transportation is available, then the incentive to have personally owned automobiles will go down. And there, perhaps, there is something we don't have to learn from the USA, because I think the USA should have perhaps devoted a little more attention to railroads, to public transport, mass transit systems, and they're coming to that now. But Amtrak used to be great, and it isn't as great as it. So I think, but there are other parts of the world we can learn from, certainly. I mean, Japan is a very good example to some extent. But you're absolutely right. This is a very important development issue, and it's an issue for India, but it's also an issue for all developing countries, because this is part of this larger concern about sustainable development. And sustainable development must have in it a balance between freedom of choice and public purpose. So if you have any suggestions, I think you should let the government of India know. But thank you for your question.
Another issue that speaks to public health and human rights and culture is was covered recently in the New York Times, and I don't know if you saw the article, about the historical preference, including among middle-class Indians, for sons over daughters, and the fact that the population is uneven, and although it is illegal, technically, for women to find the sex of their babies and therefore abort them based on sex, it happens on a regular basis. How do you begin to look at a problem like this and sort of change the way people have been thinking for a very long time?
You're absolutely right. I think it is something that we as Indians feel diminished about, to just think that there are people who would go to that extent. But it is a fact, particularly in certain parts of the country. Part of it is, of course, this whole patriarchal system, the system of inheritance and the economic imperatives of social and cultural issues, like in the absence of a social security system, the responsibility of sons to look after their aging parents. And these are built in. These are cultural issues. It's not easy to address them very quickly. But I think education, but more than that, political empowerment of women is, I think, fundamental. If more and more women become productive in society, they become economic sources of sustenance for the family. But more than that, if they exercise political power, then they are seen and perceived differently. The role model changes. I think some attempts have been made. I mean, at the Panchayati Raj system, which is the local governance at the level of the villages, where five villages come together to make. As of now, there are about 2 million directly elected people, of which 30% must be women. This number is going to go up to 50%. And our experience with them has been that women are nurturers. They are better administrators. They are more honest. They have a larger view in terms of time, in terms of development issues. So I think more and more women, if they are empowered, given economic capabilities and political power, some of this will change. But equally, we need to put this as part of our educational system, using even our more traditional religious organizations to propagate this idea that human life is human life irrespective of gender. And as you rightly said, it's already illegal. So, but there's also the now increasingly and more recently we've seen the serials that are now being shown on television. There's really been a large number of them, particularly in northern India, where these serials have raised this issue and are trying to bring awareness. So it's a slow process. I couldn't agree with you more. There's a need for addressing this issue, and the more quickly, the better. But it has to be in a democratic system done through a process of persuasion.
Let's go now to a personal passion of yours. Besides wanting to have a real life, part of the reason that you retired from the Indian Foreign Service was that you wanted to pursue some of your own interests in terms of doing things for the people of India and of the world. Can you talk about what you've been working on in intellectual property?
Yes, thank you. Well, I retired from the Foreign Service because I became 60 years of age. Mm-hmm. And it is a good time to retire because it just leaves me another few years when I can. So apart from playing more golf and traveling. Yes, you know, there is an issue which has really been there like the elephant in the room but remained unaddressed. People who are visually impaired or blind don't have access to printed works. And when we talk about visually impaired, we're not only talking about people who are completely blind, but even those who at later stage in their lives become visually impaired. Their number is today estimated at being about 314 million. This is a WHO assessment. And they don't have access. I mean, even in the developed world, they don't have access to more than 5% of printed works. Technology has changed. It used to be Braille. Braille is now not as effective. It's also labor-intensive. But digital technology is available. It's possible to have synthetic speech, to have audiobooks. But more important than that, 90% of these visually impaired are in the developing world. So one platform that's likely to be very promising is the cell phone, it's the mobile phone. It's an audio platform. If you can find a way of getting this become a receiving station, you can suddenly have very wide applications. So the World Intellectual Property Organization was mandated last year in November, when I was still ambassador in Geneva, to address this issue on a priority basis. And they have been also mandated to set up a stakeholders forum where we get the World Blind Union representatives and the publishers and libraries representatives to come and sit together and talk about the technology that's involved. Separately, they're also trying to address the legal requirements. And a treaty has been actually presented in May last year. I work with the Director General of the World Intellectual Property Organization as his honorary advisor, because this is an issue that I have a personal commitment to see how we can have greater convergence between those who need this help and those who have the rights to the books and to the products.
Is there a great deal of resistance?
In principle, no. There's a greater convergence, but the modalities have to be worked out. The technology is complex, and they're working on creating what they're called trusted intermediaries. A library, for example, those who hold the rights will make those rights available to the library. The library will then ensure that those rights are only made available to those who are visually impaired so that there is no violation of the right or the terms on which. So these modalities are being worked on. So there are two working groups that are working on this. There's also a question of getting the technology, in a sense, embedded at the time when the book is first printed, because there are economic issues there. So how do you modify the software that you need in terms of the printing technology? So these are complex issues, but these are beginning to get addressed. I'm hopeful that it will take a little while, but we are moving in that direction. And I'm hopeful that there will be a major breakthrough. A lot of corporations under their corporate social responsibility sort of umbrella are coming forward to participate in this. But the issue is, even if you agree at the international level, how do you begin to implement this at the national level? So we have to work institutionally with individual nation states and see how their laws can then be amended. And then these mechanisms put into operation. So it's a massive exercise, but it's certainly worth doing because it has implications for school children, for education, for civic information. I mean, airline timetables, railway timetables, weather. Then today, internet technology, most of these websites are not accessible by those who are visually impaired. So you need to redesign these. And these can be redesigned. So that technology is to be made available. The training has to take place. So it's a great task, but I think it's doable. And I think we will begin to see significant incremental gains maybe over the next year or so.
Is there one particular country right now that seems to be taking the lead on this that could serve as a model for everyone else?
In some ways, the U.S. is way ahead. I think we have a lot to learn from them, but there are other countries as well. So we are also looking at best practices. Spain is another country which has a very strong organization, which owns the rights to several books. But interestingly, you know, these are the difficulties. An American book cannot be sold on the same basis in Canada, for example. So how do you harmonize these? So there are issues there. I'm glad they're beginning to get addressed. And I'm glad that both sides are now talking to each other. And an organization, an UN organization like the World Intellectual Property Organization, has become the facilitator. But I think we have to be aware that at the end of the day, the decision makers will be member states. And therefore, countries will have to take positions. In one way, the positive thing is if they do take a position and support it, then we can go to their respective countries and ask them to implement it. But it's going to be a slow process. But it's going to be a process which I think I see happening in a credible time frame and which should be very satisfying and will be an important breakthrough, I think, for education, for communication, for generally making people who are visually impaired have a more accessible, normal life. And I think we owe it to them.
The last thing I want to ask you about briefly is that Prime Minister Singh is scheduled to be in Washington, D.C. in November. What do you think, just sort of looking at this from 1,000 yards, what sorts of conversations do you think will take place during that visit?
You know, again, I must clarify, I don't speak for the government, but as somebody who's been a student of international relations and had the honor of serving in the U.S. twice, once in our mission in Washington in the mid-'80s and then in Houston. You know, there's already a base for the Indo-US relationship. There is a question now of being able to build on this. And as you read out right in the beginning, they've identified four areas. The Secretary of State gave this famous 3.0 speech in New York.
By the way, we have about 15 seconds, okay. So I apologize.
So basically, four things. Coming together to help solve international issues, which are transnational. Coming together to directly contribute to India's economic development in terms of transfer of technology and investment. Support for the Indian American community. And finally, make up for lost time in our relationship because of shared values.
All good things. Thank you so much for being with us. His Excellency Swashpavan Singh will speak tomorrow night to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. However, that event is sold out. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for this opportunity.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.